I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. The Arctic is a hot topic nowadays, but there are knowledge gaps and some misinformation out there. A good primer on Arctic sovereignty and more is Who Owns the Arctic? Understanding Sovereignty Disputes in the North. Its author, Michael Byers, joins me now. The book asks and illuminates many important questions like who controls the Northwest Passage, who controls the oil and gas beneath, and how does climate change factor in all of this? Michael Byers was on last a couple of years ago for his very fine book, Intent for a Nation. He is a Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law at the University of British Columbia. He was the NDP's candidate in Vancouver Centre in last year's federal election campaign. And he's a widely respected expert on the North and more. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Michael Byers. Good morning, Professor Byers.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Why, for you, is the Arctic and Arctic sovereignty such an urgent issue?
Well, it has become an urgent issue because the sea ice is melting and accessibility to the Arctic is increasing at a truly astonishing rate. For generations, Canadians could rely upon thick, hard, multi-year ice to protect our interests in the North. Foreigners could only come if they sailed under the ice in submarines or if they broke through the ice with powerful icebreakers, and very few of them did so. But that has all changed. Within my lifetime, in the last four decades, the average annual temperature in the western Canadian Arctic has increased by 3 degrees Celsius. Now, that's happening in a place where there has always existed a fine balance between water and ice, between the frozen and the unfrozen. And, of course, that balance can be overturned by a change of much less than 3 degrees.
Now, heretofore, had other countries laid claim to the Arctic, to the North?
Well, yes. In fact, there are five countries which border on the Arctic Ocean. And each of them owns a large chunk of the Arctic. Canada is the world's second largest country and the country with the longest coastline of any country in the world, has an undisputed claim to a very large amount of territory and a large amount of seabed. The problems arise, as often is the case with neighbors, where our territory or our seabed comes up against the territory or seabed of a neighboring country, and we do have some boundary disputes. And so, for instance, we have an overlapping claim with the United States in the Beaufort Sea, north of Alaska and the Yukon Territory. It's over 6,250 square nautical miles of potentially oil and gas-rich seabed. And that is something that the two countries will have to resolve as the ice disappears and as the prices for oil and gas increase. But on the whole, most of our claim and most of the claims of other countries are accepted, and we really are talking about at most 5% of the whole that is in dispute.
So how do we resolve this? Do we go to court? Do we fight wars over this?
Well, I would suggest, and I argue quite forcefully in my book, that war is to be avoided if possible, particularly when you're talking about a potential conflict with Russia or the United States. It's much better for Canada, particularly as a middle power, as a country that's always excelled at diplomacy, to push for diplomatic solutions, for cooperation and for compromise. So to give you one small but I think promising example, Canada has a dispute with Denmark over the ownership of Hans Island. Now, Hans Island is only 1.3 square kilometers. Canada and Denmark have agreed that the dispute is only about the island. We've actually drawn a line for the maritime boundary for the entire 2,600 kilometers of the boundary between Greenland and Canada. So it really is this one tiny speck that's in dispute. And you know, politicians from both Denmark and Canada have flown there from time to time to thump their nationalist chests, usually just before election campaigns. I think we should use Hans Island as a model for cooperation and either draw a line right down the middle or, better yet, declare it a condominium, shared sovereignty, with the administration over that island being handed off to the governments of Nunavut and Greenland, which are majority Inuit, the people who have historically lived in the north.
There was a story in the last week or so about, I can't remember who it was now, an MP who wanted to rename the Northwest Passage. Is that a good idea?
I don't think so. It's interesting because the motion was put forward by a Conservative member of Parliament and almost instantly supported by all of four parties in the House of Commons, who obviously hadn't thought things through. First of all, they hadn't thought to consult with the people who actually live in and along the Northwest Passage, the Inuit. And a couple of days after the motion was put before Parliament for the first debate, the land claims organization for the Inuit, Nunavut Tungavuk Incorporated, sent a letter to all four party leaders saying, look, you actually don't only have a moral obligation to consult with us, you have a legal obligation to consult with us on changes to any geographic names within the territory of Nunavut. So it was a major oversight by all four political parties not to consult the Inuit. And I would suggest that actually, if you followed the advice of the Inuit and began to call the Northwest Passage by an Inuktitut name, that perhaps could strengthen Canadian sovereignty because the historic use and occupancy of the Northwest Passage of the ice by the Inuit is the strongest component in Canada's claim. But there's another reason why I oppose the changing of the name, the proposed name to the Canadian Northwest Passage, and that's because the only motivation for changing the name would be to somehow strengthen Canada's sovereignty by declaring it more explicitly ours. I think that particular change to the English language name would in fact have the opposite effect and suggest some insecurity with respect to our view of our legal arguments.
You know, you bring up a good point about the Inuit and the people that live there. What do they think? I mean, throughout this thing, we only hear politicians from all these five countries doing their thing about, you know, as you said earlier, chest thumping. What do they think?
Well, I hesitate to speak for them.
What do they tell you?
Yeah, well, I mean, they have, among other things, said that they like the book. And in fact, Nunavut Tungavuk, the land claims organization, publicly endorsed it a couple of weeks ago. And that, I think, is because I tried very hard to understand their perspective on the issue of not just Arctic sovereignty, but also of climate change, of economic and social development. And what certainly what they tell me is that they feel that promises to them have been broken. In 1993, the Inuit signed the Nunavut Land Claims Agreement with the federal government, and in doing so, they surrendered the possibility of a claim to Aboriginal title over one-fifth of Canadian territory. They also, in that agreement, explicitly assigned any sovereign rights that they might have acquired over the Northwest Passage through the thousands of years of living and hunting and traveling on the sea ice. And in return for that, they were made all kinds of promises by the federal government, most of which have not been fulfilled. And so Nunavut still has, you know, only a 25% high school graduation rate. It's got a suicide rate 11 times the national average. It's got a terrible housing crisis. It's got a diabetes crisis. 40% of the Inuit have diabetes. It is a social and economic disaster, and the promises made in 1993 were to make a lot of effort on the part of the federal government to help to address those things, and instead everything has gone in the opposite direction. And the Inuit, who are not a people who are angry, who become angry, are becoming instead very disillusioned by the situation they've been left in.
Now, with regards to what Harper has done with regards to the North, has any of it been good, do you think?
Oh, yes. He's certainly done a couple of good things, and I'm glad you mentioned that I ran for the NDP a year ago. I ran for the NDP because I'm so concerned about the climate change crisis, and my work in the Arctic had really driven home to me how real and how present that crisis now is. But in terms of the Arctic, Mr. Harper, to his credit, has been talking about the Arctic, which is not something that any prime minister has done much of for the last 20 years. He's visited the Arctic again, a big bonus. He's made some definitive moves, like blocking the sale of McDonald Detweiler and Associates, including that amazing satellite RADARSAT-2 that's incredibly important for our ability to surveil the North. So on a few things, he has done a good job. On other things, he's done a terrible job. He's done almost nothing to address the climate change crisis, which is the driver of so much of what's happening in the North. The crisis that is overturning the lives of the Inuit and placing some incredibly beautiful and iconic species like the polar bear at risk. He's made promises, for instance, for Arctic offshore patrol ships that have now been delayed in terms of their procurement. He made a promise for a new icebreaker for the Coast Guard, and there's been no movement on that. Across the board, really good on the rhetoric, not so good on the delivery. And perhaps, along with the lack of a serious climate change policy, he and some of his ministers, like Peter MacKay, have used rhetoric that seems designed to annoy Russia, to criticize Russia for things that are, in fact, entirely legal. Russia planted a titanium flag at the North Pole. Well, the North Pole is in high seas. It's in international jurisdiction. They were perfectly entitled to do so. Russia flew bombers on a training mission in international airspace over the Beaufort Sea. Again, completely entitled to do so. In fact, Mr. Harper and Mr. MacKay managed to get the Americans quite upset at them, at Canada, with the four-star general, the American general in charge of NORAD, publicly correcting Peter MacKay and saying that the Russians had acted professionally, by implication suggesting that Canada's defense minister had not been so professional. So there's a lot more that could be done, a much more cooperative tone that could be taken. I'd like to see more proactive diplomacy, but certainly on a scale of 1 to 10, Mr. Harper is you know, somewhere around 3 or 4 or 5, which puts him well ahead of either Jean Chrétien or Paul Martin.
Is there a sense, though, that do you get a sense, I should say, that this is a concern to people in the rest of Canada?
Oh, absolutely. I travel across this country speaking to audiences about the Arctic. And after every talk, someone comes up to me and says, oh, yes, I lived in the Arctic. I worked as an electrician on the Dew Line. I was involved in test drilling exploration for an oil company. I worked as a teacher in some small community. Hundreds of thousands of Canadians who live in the South have been to the North, and it has gotten inside their souls and affected their sense of this country and their belief that this country really should be a true North, strong and free. People who go to the Arctic fall in love with it. And even for those Canadians who haven't, there's this strong attachment to the North. It's no accident that Stan Rogers' song, The Northwest Passage, is our unofficial national anthem. It's no accident that the Inukshuk is the symbol of the 2010 Winter Olympics. We do feel an attachment to the North. I think this is something true of most northern nations. And I want us to seize upon the opportunities that exist there and also to carry the responsibilities of being a great Arctic nation. I want us to work proactively with our neighbors to solve our sovereignty disputes. I want us to work cooperatively and productively with the Inuit. I want us to protect the environment as best we can in the very challenging years and decades ahead.
Now, some will say that the other countries involved, like Russia and the United States, all they care about is the oil and gas on the seabed, as well it's a viable shipping avenue, the seaway there. These economic concerns do you think this is what drives a lot of the other countries that are involved in this dispute?
Well, again, the entire Arctic is not in dispute. Most of the oil and gas is located in less than 500 meters of water, which places it firmly within the national jurisdictions of one or another coastal state, because under international law, a coastal state has rights over the seabed out to 200 nautical miles, and if it can demonstrate scientifically a natural prolongation, much further than that. So what we're seeing right now is a serious effort on the part of all five Arctic nations to map their seabed, to collect scientific evidence, to establish that their claims are legitimate. And concurrent with that, there will be necessarily negotiations concerning overlaps, small overlaps between claims. But the oil and gas will actually be worked out. There's more than enough to go around, particularly when one realizes the terrible irony that the only reason we can think about accessing Arctic oil and gas is because we burn so much already. And so if we actually are going to address the crisis of climate change, we're certainly not going to be exploiting oil and gas in the high Arctic near the North Pole at any time in the future. The question about shipping is also very interesting, and as the ice melts, there will be shipping routes that open. The Northwest Passage offers a shortcut between Shanghai and New Jersey of around 7,000 kilometers, and that is going to be very attractive to shipping companies who want to save fuel and save time. Now, having said that, it's not Canada's position that we're going to close off the Northwest Passage. Instead, the position is that ships from around the world can use the passage with our permission if they comply with our environmental standards. And my view is that we should actually invest significantly in developing a safe and efficient shipping route, that we should have world-class search and rescue, that we should have world-class navigation aids and charts, that we should have ports of refuge, that we should do everything possible to ensure that ships in the Northwest Passage can proceed safely. And if we can do that, then, of course, they will be much more receptive to our legal claims.
And currently, the threat of terrorism in the North, say terrorists gaining access by way of the North, or other criminals like drug smugglers or gun runners, illegal immigration and the sort, that's a possibility now?
It is certainly a possibility now. I can give you several examples of attempts at illegal immigration in the North, including a couple of Turkish sailors who jumped ship at Churchill, Manitoba a couple of years ago, a young Romanian man who actually bought a motorboat in Greenland and sailed it across Baffin Bay. There will be problems of that kind in the future as the ice melts and the North becomes more accessible. I can imagine that in 10 or 20 years, a boatload of refugees or refugee claimants from Sri Lanka might actually choose to go north rather than to come to the west coast of Vancouver Island, where they will be spotted and they will be apprehended quite quickly. The North is seriously underpoliced, and we don't have the capacity to know everything that's going on. Now, having said all that, it's important not to overemphasize these security risks. They are there. We have to deal with them. And we do need to make investments to be there. But the most important component of the security risks from non-state actors is that the United States is very concerned about them. Paul Cellucci, when he was the U.S. ambassador to Canada back in 2004, actually went so far as to say that the United States should recognize Canada's legal position concerning the Northwest Passage, because Canada could then protect the United States against the terrorist threat in the North. Now, even if that assessment of the terrorist risk was exaggerated, I believe that Canada should have seized the opportunity to negotiate with the United States to walk through the door that Mr. Cellucci had opened. If their primary concern is terrorism and our primary concern is environmental protection, well, as long as we're pointed in the same direction, that should be good for all of us.
You say in the book that the question isn't who owns the Arctic, rather, are we as a country up to the task? Do you think Canada is?
I think that remains to be seen. I think Canadians want us to be up to the task. I think Canadians feel that we are a northern people, that this is a true north, strong and free. And they're looking for politicians to exercise leadership here. It's one of the reasons why I think Mr. Harper has spoken so often about the Arctic. He realizes that Canadians care about this. And it's striking how no opposition politicians oppose Mr. Harper on his sovereignty thrust, because sovereignty, protecting Canadian sovereignty in the North, is a little bit like motherhood and apple pie. It can't be opposed. And so we need to actually drill down into the substance of what's being proposed, what's being promised. And that's why I wrote this book. I want people to get beyond the rhetoric and the easy nationalism, and to understand the North, understand our sovereignty disputes in their full context, so that we can judge the merit of policy proposals, and we can also hold politicians to account. Like I said, I think Mr. Harper has done better than some of his predecessors in the Arctic, but that doesn't mean that we should give him a free pass on this. we still have to have understanding, we have to have a rigorous debate, and we need to make sure the promises are fulfilled.
Will you run again?
That is a pretty personal question, and the answer there is not immediately for family reasons, but at some point, most certainly. I care deeply about this country. I want to help make it an even better place, and I do feel a certain call to run for office and to let the voters decide whether or not they wish me to represent them in Ottawa.
You've been to the Arctic many times. What struck you the most about the people there?
The thing that struck me most about northern Canadians, and here I include Indigenous people as well as non-Indigenous Northerners, is how much they love this country, how much they look at this country very much as a cohesive and a cohesive whole from sea to sea to sea, and how they feel this incredible pride in the fact that Canada is 40% Arctic, that we have this incredible history of Arctic exploration, that we have this embracing of Inuit culture with the soapstone carvings and the prints and the Inukshuks at the Olympic Games, that there is this sense that the North is an integral part of what it means to be Canadian. They obviously want us to do a much better job of listening to them and of helping them work to achieve their goals, including a standard of living that's comparable to what we have in the rest of Canada. But never, ever doubt that Northern Canadians, including the Inuit, are fiercely proud to be Canadian and stand 110% behind our sovereignty claims.
We mustn't lose sight of that, and this book is an incredible chance to continue thinking about the North. Professor Bice, congratulations on the book and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation.
You're very welcome. The book is called Who Owns the Country? Understanding Sovereignty Disputes in the North. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Do pick it up. It's an important book, timely. And as Professor Byers says, we mustn't lose sight of the people there and our country there. Michael Byers on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.